Welcome to the Jax Jones and Martin Warner Show.
Exploring the role of music in making a great film epic. Today, we've an exciting guest whose credits include some of the most epic films. If you've watched a film in the last 10 years, you've seen, even longer than that, you've seen and heard this master at work. He's written the music for over 70 titles, including Iron Man 3, Avengers, Age of Ultron, and even this. And of course, the Fast and Furious series, the latest of which is F9, which is in cinemas right now. Mr. Brian Tyler, welcome to the Jax Jones and Martin Warner Show.
Hey, good to see you.
Listen, you look in like you're in a really nice spot right now. I'm seeing a bunch of awards. Where are you right now, mate?
You know, it's like I'm actually in my studio right now. I'm at the mixing board here. And so, yeah, I've got some... kind of everything lined up, and then over there in the other room, it's the drums and the Rhodes and the pianos and all that stuff. Getting my adjustment.
It's
here.
A beautiful space.
Yeah, I love it.
So, what are those awards in the background there? I see like is a Grammy. Is that a Grammy there? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of BMI awards, Oscar. There's a YouTube thing there, but mostly it's like. Film and television music awards and things like that stuff. But I kind of like it basically because it reflects light really well.
It's an estate. Are you sure it's not to let people know what time it is? Like when you've got a director in the hot seat next to you, like, yeah, I know what's best because just look behind you, mate. So you guys couldn't see that. Brian has positioned the awards to be on each side of the director's ears.
it's like inches away from the back of their head, so they feel it burning a hole in the back of their head. It's a slight influential thing. And also, like, I the ones that are glass, I kind of put lights behind them. It just, because it looks nice. It just looks nice.
They do reflect light remarkably well. Yeah, in terms of, like, practical usage, I would say they're kind of prismatic.
They are prismatic, exactly. No, it's a good time. You can actually, I've tried, believe it or not, I've tried sending, like, a laser through the one end.
Ooh.
Yeah, and just to see what would happen, and it's awesome, but it's kind of distracting for meetings. So,
and your studio is considerably nicer than mine as well. Like, film composers generally have beautiful studios. Is that like a thing?
Well, you know, it's funny. My studio actually, if like we were in the other room too, my studio's quite a bit. It's probably a bit larger than a normal cinematic composer studio because I produce, you know. And record like, you know, pop and hip hop and electronic records and stuff. I'm constantly like kind of recording. And then because I love recording as much as I can ahead of time too, before I go to like conduct anything. So I have like two drum kits in there. There's like three pianos. There's a lot of space for like live recording. Right. I can set up a string section. Right. I do vocals, all the guitars. And then I mix here too. And like all those outboard synths and analog old gear. Yeah. And it's a pretty big space. And then I have like an underground area. I've got upstairs. There's like assistants up there, up the stairs. It's a whole building.
It's amazing.
It's impressive. I think a really good place to start because Brian's clearly a hybrid, right, in terms of competency. And he's making a name or made a name in many respects in a number of areas. So, Brian, it's a good question. Just let's set the context for the listener and the viewer. How do you split your time and what's what you really... I mean, we've got you on the show because you're a great music composer, but we know you're a DJ. We know there are a few more things
it's,
to you,
The way I grew up, there was something about the love of music instilled in me that I just gravitated towards that was not genre-specific. It was very wide. Mm. You know, on piano, I was really drawn to things like Chopin, and then I really loved jazz piano. And so it's kind of... In the piano world, that's kind of two worlds. And then, of course, like, you know, pop acts that, you know, you could play piano, Billy Joel, Elton John, that kind of thing. But in the other world, I was really, you know, I loved orchestral music and everything from, like, older classical all the way through, like, Bartok up through, like, very modern minimalist and avant-garde 20th century classical composers, film composing, John Williams,
nice.
Into a lot of conductors. And then I was definitely... on drums, kind of a metal kid, you know, and played professionally as a drummer kind of lean towards the like Rage Against the Machine vibes. And then I was a hip hop kid. I loved hip hop and like programming. I even did like popping and locking like battles.
Crazy.
And, yeah, like I was really, really into that early hip hop all the way through. Did a lot of programming, 808s, 909s, they got into rave 303s. And like all along the way, I was like not just kind of casually interested in these things. I was hyper, hyper invested in trying to deconstruct every one of these genres, like a maniac. And I was born with something that's called synesthesia. And it's this kind
you
of...
You can see music in color.
Yeah, it's kind of a... it's like
is that not the right term? Is that not the definition?
Yeah, it's technically kind of like a condition.
I think Pharrell has it as well.
I didn't know that. I've actually worked with him. That's weird. That's interesting. It's a really strange thing. And so I didn't discover it that I kind of had that till later, but I think that had something to do with the... I see like...
Right.
Like it was like early on, like getting into like Public Enemy and Tribe Called Quest and all that with that. But at the same time, I would see color, like interesting color kind of convergence between that and Dvorak. And it was just and even the ways people spoke or sound effects or like it kind of all made sense in terms of wanting to really master a lot of instruments, play a lot of instruments. So
I remember Rick Rubin, there was a question that someone posed to him where he said, if you wanted to become a music producer, what do you do, right? And his response was, your first place to start is to listen to the greatest albums of all time. And the first thing you should do is look at a pretty good list, like the Rolling Stones top 100 albums and go through it one by one, yeah? So I think it'd be useful to people to hear, in your opinion, the accomplished composer who's basically coming across like a polymath of music right now, as you listed all your curiosity. It's actually quite intimidating, but also very admirable and awe-inspiring because you can translate that to anything. But what would be your top three movie soundtracks of all time, movie scores of all time?
This is like picking three randomly out of probably like my favorite 2000 or something. Yeah. So big one for me would be Vangelis, 1492, Conquest of Paradise is kind of a deeper cut, but like, right? And then I would say, I'm going to go with Vertigo, Bernard Herrmann. It kills me. It also does something that I love to do, which is feature writing for the viola, the folks sitting in the middle that often get overlooked because violins can do their entire range and cellos can do their entire range. So they're not given, but the viola d'amore, solo that's so beautiful and actually gets a main title credit because Bernard Herrmann, the composer, made the studio do it. It's the only time I've ever seen it where it's like, score by Bernard Herrmann and music composed by Bernard Herrmann. And it's like, you know, viola solos, viola d'amore solos. But so super cool, beautiful, haunting, just destroys my soul. I love it.
destroys my soul. Amazing.
It instantly makes me cry. So, and then I'm going to go with E.T., John Williams.
Oh, yes, man.
Talk about telling a story with the music. I remember as a kid, I'll put that on and I could see the whole movie. I could hear E.T. and Elliot, you know, just... Again, killing me softly, right? Yeah. It's just beautiful.
Yeah. You can relive the movie through that music. So
well, it does.
Obviously, you've got to see it, but then it lives forever.
100%. It was because of Star Wars and E.T. and a lot of John's music and also, you know, just so many of the greats that I would put it on, and that is why I started... in a way, inverting the process, and I would read books, like science fiction books, and even science fact books. I was very huge into science. In fact, that's why I loved your Brian Cox episode, by the way. So I would read Carl Sagan or Hawking or Richard Feynman or Penrose. And as a kid, I would write music to kind of score it. Now, granted, I only could play it on the piano, but in my head, since I had no access to an orchestra, I was fascinated with the idea of doing what John Williams did, which was to write for orchestra, but then also expand the instrumentation to things like a CS-80 that Vangelis used and a Jupiter 8 that Martin Gore was using with Depeche. And these things, and in my mind, I couldn't afford those things. I didn't have them. I had a piano in my brain. And so I'd write it down. And the craziest thing for me was that I actually ended up doing what I do. And I wrote this whole kind of score for Children of Dune, which was the between Dune, Dune Messiah, and Children of Dune was like the middle book of the Frank Herbert series. And when I started scoring, it was kind of crazy. In 2003, this director called me up, Greg Utanis, and I'd just done Plan B for him, which was like this jazz, big band, Diane Keaton comedy score. So it had nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But he calls me, he's like, yo, Disney is making this this adaptation of Dune Messiah and Children of Dune, these Frank Herbert novels. You probably never heard of them, da da da. Maybe you have. And would you like to score it? And I'm thinking, like, what are you talking about? Of course. Yes. And so.
Crazy. Dream come true.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, actually, when I went to the opening salvo of that score, which is called Seleucus Secundus, was what I wrote when I was 12. And so it was like a nod to the dreamer that I was. And so when I got up to conduct it's that kind of thing where someone looks up and is like, I want to be a Formula One driver, like Lewis. And like he literally, like, you know, he told Ron Dennis when he was a kid, I'm going to be a driver for you in McLaren.
Yeah.
And sure as hell he was. But it was like, this felt like way out of my reach. And so I'm really lucky to be doing what I'm doing, honestly.
How old were you when you scored your first film?
21.
Oh my God. So you see, when I picture like film composers, I imagine someone perhaps balding or with wiry hair, some bad posture because they've been conducting for so long.
Like, no, trust me, you know, I was like the absolute anomaly. Like, who the fuck is this? That sounded like Conor McGregor. Who the fuck is this guy?
Was that your Conor McGregor impression?
Remember in that sure press conference, he's looking around and that one guy's behind him? Anyway, but I have a better ankle. I mean, I've been working with orchestras though since I was like 14, because I did this concerto and I was like all over Europe playing with orchestras and whatnot. So I was used to it, but in film composing, damn, I mean, I was way off by like a 20-year gap between kind of what would be considered young. Yeah, yeah. Even a young one would be 40. And so I remember getting, in fact, I remember I was at Abbey Road and I think it was Abbey Road and it was London Symphony or London Phil, I'm not sure. Basically, when I got up to the podium, and I mean, like, no one knew who I was, I got a movie based on my music, and when I showed up for the interview, they're like, what on earth are you doing? Because it was a requiem that they heard that they wanted to use, so they were kind of picturing, like, exactly what you're saying, turtleneck, you know, like the old, you know, kind of...
wiry hair.
Yeah, like kind of academic tweed or whatever. So so I got up there in like a t-shirt and it was in the morning and the orchestra is kind of tuning up and I get up on the podium and I'm nervous as hell. And like, I remember the cellist. Oh no, this was in LA. It was in LA at Sony Pictures. Yeah, easy. Yeah. And so I got up to the podium and I remember David, one of the cellists who's a good friend, but he's like John Williams, cellist, and Steve Erdodi, and Bruce Dukoff, and all these players that I had only seen by looking at the CD like booklets for who plays for John Williams, and that's how I decided on. They're like, "Who do you want to use for the orchestra?" And I'm like, "Oh my God! Like, you mean I can just say names?" And so I went through and I got out actually Saving Private Ryan. I think the CD booklet I just typed in an email and sent it to them. Yeah. Yeah, so they're like, wow, what an informed list, you know? Anyway, so I did that, and I get up there, and I get up to the podium, and I look to the side, and of course, not to blame, but the cellist says, hey, son, could you hook me up? I can't hear, my headphones are jacked up, and the light doesn't work on my...
He thought you were a techie.
Yeah, yeah.
He thought you were a techie.
So then I walked back down, and then Sandy DeCrescent, who is the contractor for John Williams and everybody, she got up there and was like, I want to introduce you to. And then I got up there and I was like, what up? To like right to the cellist. And So yeah, there was a bit of that kind of like, who the hell, you know? But it was great. And I like, really, even in London, I'm there so much conducting, and I do concerts and work with that orchestra. And here in LA, all over the world, you know, Vienna and whatnot. And so it's been great, but there was certainly a bit of that time when I was coming up where I looked like a child, and I had to really kind of prove myself. So I would write music. There would be one piece in the movie that would be so insanely technically difficult to play for everybody. I can write for, because I play cello and these things. So I don't write like their parts like a piano player. Like often composers, they'll write kind of how their instrument is, but having another musician play it, and I kind of write specifically for the instrument, you know? And so I would...
So you play cello, piano, drums.
I mean, yeah.
What else? Everything.
It's like, I don't know, it's like 30 or 40. It's a lot. I always try to learn something, like a new instrument, many times a year even. Yeah, so that's those ones I can play. Some of them I'm not great at, of course. You know, some of them I'm studio level and I can play in an orchestra. It varies. But I at least like to be able to play it so I can understand where they're coming from. So when someone's playing a violin, I know, okay, don't do it with that kind of jump, because if you're doing an arpeggiation there's an open string that you can take advantage of. It makes it easier. So why don't we revoice that ostinato and all that. So I did everything like completely inverted, where it was like the most insano hard to, you know, the poor trumpet player is going from B flat and jumping down to F sharp, like high, way out of the range, super fast, stopping on a dime, switching to 9/8, doing triplets at 64th notes and brrr, just to be like, just to drop that in there. I don't do that anymore, but I used to do it just to kind of, I felt I like almost need to. I didn't. The poor people, they, you know, everyone's guilty of the judging a book by its cover. It happens all the time. So
these people
are so damn talented. The sum total of talent in that room is absurd to the level of 10 to the 25th power. Like, it's out of control how talented they are. You know, they were the best of the best of the best of the best of the town that they grew up in. And then they were the best of the best of the best at Juilliard. You know, like in their one instrument. And then maybe they make it into the orchestra. Yeah.
Were you intimidated by
that? Yeah. I'm standing in front of these people, like.
Because you never studied music.
No, I'm still.
So, like, you're coming in all flair.
Yeah, I mean, I studied music all my life, but in a sense, I'm self-taught, so.
But not formally like them.
Yeah, I did piano. That was the formal thing I did, but that was, like, after the fact. And even drums, but I had been playing for a long time, and then you were like, maybe you should get some formal. But harmony theory, all those counterpoints, I went and I autodidact, completely dove into all the theory books and everything and lectures. Amazing. And whatnot, so I could learn terms to kind of concepts I already knew. So I didn't know what circle of fifths was. I didn't know what counterpoint was, or antiphonal, or you know, all these different extended techniques and things, so I could speak with the orchestra, because I needed to be able to write it down and speak about every single instrument. So I know what the oboe does, and the clarinet, and the bass clarinet, and the contrabass clarinet, and the trombones. Da, da, da. So I need to be able to talk to all of them about why the harp pedaling isn't right. So I had to learn that, in a sense, which was a joy for me, because just kind of like it made me able to write differently, knowing what these instruments could do. I was like, I didn't know that you could play a cello down by there, and it did sul ponticello, which is this kind of like harmonized weird sound with the bow, and so I started doing that, you know, and the education of it was really important. I just did it in a kind of odd way, and that's all.
Has anyone ever trashed something you've done? Like,
well, like a director, you've got to collaborate with directors.
Oh, that's different,
right? That's a different thing. But do they reject you? Like, you do think a bit like with Ross, right? You know, you can't help it, you put something out there. Did you like?
You're talking about Diana Ross.
Yeah.
Did you just call her Ross?
Well, no, I didn't. I wanted to get your acknowledgement without having to get into detail. But the point is, we've all produced something and we say, that's fucking great. And then someone says, yeah, can you try something else?
Yeah, I guess, because I guess the director has a vision for a scene as well. And you've got your interpretation. And obviously you work together to be as close to that as possible. But have they ever,
when you have
Brian,
disagreements,
this ain't it, bro.
And there are disagreements that are honest disagreements, and then there are disagreements that happen. See, I'm so used to doing this process, and typically they're not actually used to even, most directors have done three average maybe three films, two, three, maybe.
They wouldn't have done as many films as scoring-wise.
So not only have they not like written a score, they've written that zero times. But even in terms of working with, so there's things after doing like 100 films myself, there are certain patterns that I can see if maybe they're doing something that isn't helping themselves. It's almost like they're used to hearing something a certain way. So when something's different, they don't realize this is actually helping the scene more than the, and it's some, if there's some psychological thing. In terms of that, you have to be very, I'm not digging in heels at all. I just want you to look at it this way. And so, because you really only want the best for them in their film. And sometimes it's hard for them to know that. But on the whole, my 99.9999999999% of the time, part of what I do that's probably a strength of mine is being able to empathetically hear like emotion through music through a scene. So it's a Rosetta Stone I have with a director. What I do is I say, tell me what you want from this scene emotionally. So he's not saying, use a clarinet. It's like, I was like, what is it that you want? And I want to get really specific.
What do you want to feel?
Yeah, like down to the point of like, there is a push in on this character and you're looking in her eyes. And
absolutely.
What is she thinking? And she's like, oh, well, she's thinking of her husband that had died. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to subtly start playing the husband's theme or something like that, right? So instead of doing the obvious thing is playing her theme. Like, we're going to do something like that to do it very subtly, sneak in and out. And if we have that common language of what he wants from the scene, it's rare that it's like, no, that wasn't the vast majority of the time. But when it's something that maybe like I see the scene differently and I'm like, oh, that's what you meant? And then it's like, oh, great. Yeah, I'm back to the drawing board. There's no problem. You know, I have no ego about it at all.
That's so cool. I think this is a good point for us to segue onto your process, which I think is super important. It's really interesting. Like, what is the process of writing a score for you? For example, like, are you in the first script readings, you know, trying to think of the music for each scene? Like, how does it work? Where do you begin? Can you run us through?
Yeah. So I begin pretty early now because I tend to work with people I've worked with before. I could easily right now be still looking for my first movie. You know, I mean, I'm quite aware of, I could easily be, you know, like a street musician or something. Like, you never know, but.
Why'd you say that?
Because the number of things that had to line up that, what I mean? Like I play, you know, to have a Requiem played that someone heard that then sent it to it's, you know, at least as someone that didn't go to film school or music school, so I don't have any like friends that are in the biz. I had to come from the outside. As I went to Harvard, I was back there. The thing I loved to do is there was a guy, Ned Landon, who played on the street corner, his guitar. And he was like, I felt like maybe the greatest folk music writer maybe to ever live. But no one knows who he is. He played on the street corner.
No one knows who he is.
I mean, some crazy people do.
Yeah, I hear you.
But like, he goes by Flathead. He doesn't, you know, he's not a, he's a guy that plays on the street, literally. Like, and he has his dog that sits in his like guitar case. His lyrics, the way he writes a melody. I would sit there with the buses whirring by and every day, and I would stand there for like 2 hours and watch this guy. Like,
I didn't know you went to Harvard.
Yeah. So what were you saying? No, my process is basically is that
so you know the direct typically you know the directors.
Right. Yeah.
Then what happens?
And so I get the script. What happens is I just kind of get a sense of what it might be, and sometimes it influences the way things are. So it depends on the project. Now, I have done it many times. I got to say, like in 2003 or 2004, somewhere in there, I was working on a film for William Friedkin, The Hunted, and over at Paramount, and I was also scoring Star Trek. This is like early days for me, and I remember I was conducting Star Trek, and I had heard that Jerry Goldsmith, who is one of my idols, was dropped from the movie Timeline, and which was Richard Donner's film, and based on the Michael Crichton book, and I signed an online petition. I was like, how dare Paramount drop Jerry Goldsmith? He is the, you know, like, this is how, and I was a notable kind of name on the list. Well, the movie was coming out. Lo and behold, guess who got the call to replace Jerry Goldsmith? So, yeah, this is my idol. Like, this is when we were talking about
conflict.
Remember, you were just saying who are your favorite? I listed him next to Ennio, right? So I'm like, what? And it's like Richard Donner, the director of The Omen and Superman and, you know, Goonies and everything. So I go in and meet with him, and he's like, yeah, look, we got, like, we love your work. We heard Children of Dune, the thing that I, and they tempt the whole movie with his music. Well, in that case, I had like 9 days, and that was on paper, full on orchestra.
You had 9 days to score this whole
film. Yeah, it was like nine, maybe 10. It was very short. And that was to get to the...
How many pieces is that? How many pieces of music are we talking?
Like 70. Something like...
Lord of mercy. 70 pieces of music in 9 days.
For a full orchestra. So you had to write violins, second violins, viola, basses, trombones, bass trombones, French horns, flutes, clarinets, bass clarinets, harp parts, the percussion, timpani, marimba, piano, the vocal, the choir, beyond inhuman.
So the pressure is
inhuman.
On.
Inhuman.
The pressure is on.
So this is where film composers have this weird, we probably all, unless somehow... there's a couple composers that really can take a long time with a movie. I know Cliff Martinez is able to work with directors, and he kind of gets in early. But I'm sure he could do things quickly. But there is you have to hear the music in your head and not second guess yourself and absolutely start immediately writing. And that was how long I had to then record it. I conducted it to the very, very, very last second, and I conducted the main title last with one take at the very end of the day when the clock was running down, because that's how tight it was, and then we mixed it and put it in there. It is what, there's no second guessing when it comes to a schedule like that. So there's the other extreme, and I've done that probably four or five times in my life, and it...
Would you say you get better, do you get a better result that way, or do you prefer to spend more time?
I think you get... you get your first impression, which I think 90% of the time is right, but you miss maybe that 10% where the second version is better.
Funny enough, I've spoke to other composers about this and directors, and I think there's two things that composers must do extremely well, and I'd be interested in your critique or if this relates to you. And by the way, John Barry, John Williams, they would follow this approach, right? And that is, you got to get in early, right? You got to be first to the party. Build that collaboration with the director, and then they give you a script, and you're like, okay, you don't know exactly how the scenes are going to play out. You don't even know what's on the faces. All you've got are words, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the first opportunity for you to develop a vision for the theme, right? So you start to get to work on themes, right? Is there a husband theme, right? You know, what is the subplot, right? You know, how stylistic does it have to be? Is it about space? Whatever, right? Yeah. And then what happens, John Williams calls it the spotting process. I kind of love this concept.
Yeah.
That when the actual footage is done, then you get your notepad out or whatever, and you sit with the director and go, well, what scenes need music, right?
Yeah. Mm.
Do you do that? Is that your kind of process?
Every time, yeah. So I will sit down and I will watch the music, and they'll have temp music on, and I'll just mute it. And I'll watch the film, and it's like, at this point, the nervousness of a director is completely justified in the sense that they're handing their baby over to one person at the end of the movie. One thing that a director can do. It's funny, John Chu was talking about this, director of Crazy Rich Asians, and he was like, look, Brian, I can direct a film. I can shoot. I know how to use lenses. I can even act badly. I can write a script. I can do technically, I could light, I could do gaffer, I could technically do everything on this film. If you hand me a baton, I have no idea what to do. It is such a mystery that it's scary for them. So at this point, it's like, I take the movie and it's like, okay, here I go. This is what I think. I see this vision, and I will hear the music in my head, when it should come in and out, what I think, and then I spot it, which is like, here is the point which music starts, but you don't really hear it yet. And by here, we so subtly crescendo at such a tiny rate, you don't even know that music snuck in the door. So you're not aware that you're in a movie theater. You're just like, there's music there all of a sudden, but it happens so soft. Then you start to do it, and you subtly do it, because I never want to be the, like, hi, look at me. I'm music. You know, you don't want it to be where the film, you feel the camera's here. Sometimes with movie scores. I feel like here's the camera, and if the camera just went to the left, you see an orchestra playing, right? So so you want to do it so it's organic to the film. You do your thing, and then you sneak out the back door. Don't even notice it's gone. And so that's my spotting area. So what I'm doing is I'm giving them handles of the slope of when it comes in and out, and then talking to the director and saying, I think we need this here. I think we want to be counter here. If it's a thriller, sometimes I'll say, I want a misdirect or a red herring. I'm going to do three red herrings in a row. At number three, the audience is going to figure out that I'm doing a red herring, and it won't be a red herring on number four. Things like that. So to get the psychology.
What do you mean by that?
Red herring. So like doing a movie like Scream or anything like that's like a thriller, Frailty, so it's that specific genre, let's say. I will do music that is intentionally leading you down the wrong path emotionally. So something happens and it shocks you. So I will.
You playing with
us. Yeah, and I will do things with tempos where things are landing on such an offbeat that you kind of get in a rhythm and you subconsciously are tapping out and something happens on the offbeat. Well, you may do that a few times, and then subconsciously the audience might figure out that that's what you're doing. So then,
got you.
And this usually on the third time. So after that, then you don't do the red herring. You do the obvious thing, which shocks them. So
you're directing as well. Yeah, this is crazy.
It's all psychoacoustic. The psychology of music and what it does is insane. Like there are studies with infants where they film infants' faces across the globe, all cultures, and do like a 7-chord, a 6-chord, a flat 6-chord, a minor, a diminished, all these things, and the facial expressions to about 95% are almost identical. So like the happy for the major, the sad for the minor, but also like a 7-chord kind of having like a question mark, a flat 6, a tritone, like having like eyes go wide open, mouth opens, all sorts of things. So 5% of the population is actually deaf to harmonic mood.
Yeah, I read that somewhere. I heard it was more. It's about 50% are like tone deaf.
Tone deaf, that's different. So tone deaf is that you can't distinguish, like you wouldn't be able to sing a song, a note back to someone. No, this is that if you play literally a chord that would make everyone feel like melancholy or a very specific emotion, they don't hear it that way. They're like, oh, is that time to party? You know, like there's something.
Oh, is it like being colorblind, yeah, but music
but
blind,
like
basically.
By two chords. Yeah, so it's 5%. So,
mad.
And I that's believe it or not, I've actually worked with like a couple directors that were actually, that's really tough. Because they'll,
that sucks.
Yeah, you'll do something that everyone in the room is like, oh my God, and they will, it's not their fault. They just, it's probably
laughing at a funeral.
Yeah, 100%. Sometimes the emotions are inverted, or sometimes it's a close cousin. But it's basically like taking a grenade, and if you had all the words of all the emotions, and just going, and then like coming back, and it like connecting to the chords randomly in their
That's
mind.
Amazing.
It's weird, but it's a real phenomenon. So, but what I'm saying is that like that I use that kind of psychology that works with 95% of the population to kind of do the job. 50% of my job is kind of emotional manipulation or creating emotion with music. And then the other 50% is clarifying the narrative of what's happening in the story, which you can do by things like themes and motifs and leitmotifs and whatnot to kind of guide you through the story a little bit more clearly and provide that. But to me, that may be 50-50, but to me it's like 80% emotion, really, if you think about it. So I'm very aware of how those chords
work. What's the saddest chord?
It's probably, I would say like a 9, like a minor 9 or a flat 6, kind of minor 6. Like it's just on the edge of being like dissonant to the point where you're like, but it's painful. It's painful, but still beautiful. And that to me is sadness.
What's the most enjoyable part of the process?
Good question.
And when do you know it's actually finished?
Yeah, I would say it kind of, it's funny because it's different on every project. So often, I'm the one that really sticks out to me is if it's an orchestral score, it's getting up there and conducting the orchestra. I mean, it's just such a rush. It is like, that is the musician's version of Oh my God! I just piloted an F1 fighter. You know what I mean? It's like the Top Gun. Right. So that is an insane rush. Or conducting in concert, the piece that you did. So especially satisfying if it was a piece that one of those executives didn't like, but ended up being the one that's like number one on your Spotify that everyone cheers for, that you get to conduct, and you're like, I'm in concert. Ha ha ha. Anyway, I'll tell you what, the even beyond that, whether it's a director or for people that I know that come in, and it's happened on Are We Dreaming a bunch because it's so personal, I'll play a piece if I turn around and I was like, what do you think? And you see tears, like it affected them.
Oh my God! Yeah.
Something just happened. I actually have recorded, which I'm so glad I did. I happen to have a voicemail recording, and I just played something, and I played something. It was like stunned silence for like 8 seconds. I was like, "What's going on here?" He says, "That's the best piece of music I've ever heard." He just kept on saying, "Ever." That moment of like, my God, just seeing joy on someone else's face through your music, it's better than like the premiere or like a one-on-one person. It could be my wife. It could be someone I don't know. It could be whatever it is. If someone is affected by something, and sometimes when I'm doing Are We Dreaming, and someone will come up to me afterwards and like, someone did, this guy Peter, I still know, he came up and he said, I brought my son to your show, and with that piece, we experienced something that's hard to explain, but we now have a bond together that I never thought we'd have, and we never had before. For some reason, some moment, like a trigger. So it was like a life thing. Those things are way, way, way beyond.
It's crazy.
Yeah, where you don't expect that because you're, you know. But those are amazing. And then also if you get past some kind of adversity. Like when, so for me, I'm a huge Formula One fan. And like massive, crazy fan. So when Formula One called me up and was like, hey, you know, we love your music. We're thinking of maybe branding Formula One with the theme that's worldwide, since every territory plays a different song. I kind of want to do the Olympics. That was so terrifying because I didn't want it to ruin my favorite sport. If I struck out and failed writing that theme, it's like Eminem, Mom Spaghetti. You get up there, you give them that chance to do it, and you fucking like you nosedive and fail. Now I can't even. Now every time I watch Formula One, I'd be like crying, you know. Like I had this opportunity.
So what do you do?
Oh my God! What I did is actually, you know what triggered it? I just sat there. It was the longest time I had the blank page I think ever. I was just like,
How long are we talking? A day? A couple hours?
It was like a month. I usually can write something and start writing something that I really feel is the strongest version within 5 minutes. Like, you know, that's usually, so this was like amazing. A month goes by and I'm like, everything sounds, what? Like, so what I realized is why I love Formula One is all the emotion of when things go wrong and your team or your driver is down and then something happens that's victorious, but also those moments of tragedy. Like as a Kimi fan, I remember he'd be like, he's gonna win the championship. Wing flies off, goes into the wall. No! You know, and so Lewis, when he came on the scene, he was my favorite. I was like, this guy, and he was with Alonso, teamed up with him in McLaren, junior driver, newest driver.
Yep.
I'm watching the season. I'm like so pro Lewis, and this is what got me to write the theme. I remember that experience of watching him come to the pits and Alonso blocking him and all this, and how close he got to winning the championship and just barely by a point, one turn, bumping into Kimi Raikkonen, and I think at China, that threw it away. Comes back, it's the last race, he just needs to finish, I forget what, fifth? And he is stuck behind Sebastian Vettel, starts raining, there's no way he can pass him. And I'm just like, it's happening again. Oh my God, he was gonna win, he's gonna lose the championship by 1 point to Massa. Anyway, I remember that feeling of when he came around the corner, passed Timo Glock in the last corner, wins the championship by a point, everyone goes bonkers. You see his brother hugging him and his father and the thing, I was like screaming my head off, and it was such a moment. I went back and I watched that, and then boom, the theme came to me. because it was the emotion. It wasn't the action that did it. It was the emotion.
Yeah. So that's how you get over writer's block, is you come from emotion. Mm-hmm. That's cool,
right,
man.
Yeah, I can't escape it. So sometimes I say, if something's going on personal in my life, or something, if someone's being a bit hard on me, or we get in an argument, I'm like, I got to pull out of this like whole situation, because I do have something due and I'm going to be conducting in 2 days. And this will block my ability to write music. And so it is a tough kind of haul sometimes, just being personally and like family and all that, because I'm so affected by things that I kind of have to be like, you know, it's not like I can go in and be angry and work on some real estate contract or, you know, like an attorney, where you just, it doesn't work that way.
This is a feeling for you.
Yeah, we all need that.
Are you a one-man show?
Yeah.
In terms of your work, do you have a team, or are you just all on your Jack Jones?
Yeah, I write the music, and I also, all the way to mixing and mastering, I'm really, really, really particular. Like, I can't let anything go, but I have like a support team of assistants and things that keep the business and going. Like,
but you're the sole creative force,
right? Creative.
Yeah, that all comes from you.
You are the end to end, right? In terms of what you produce.
Like, that's usually at the mix stage is when composers hand things off. No way. Like, because I produce music.
You sonic as well, so you actually know production.
I can't.
So do you?
I can't let that go.
Your days must be crazy.
Yeah, they're long.
Like, or do you keep a strict schedule for your creativity? Like, are you a morning creative and late creative? Like, or do you just work?
Yeah, I work. Like, I mean, I work typically till, what was it this morning? I probably work till like 5 or 6 in the morning every day, something like that. Because I don't. Because the creative process starts. I try to start doing it in the day, but it's phone calls and things like that, and then. Once it kind of tapers off, nighttime is when I'm not interrupted. And I'll be doing that, getting ready for going out to do the casting and choreography, like all the rehearsals for the live musical in like 4 or 5 days. So I'll be cranking.
That's amazing.
Well, I mean, it's a tough schedule when you add things that are not cyclical, like promo and stuff like that, that you then have to go and do, and or sourcing new projects and all that stuff. It sounds like you've got a great pipeline, but... we all work long hours. That's a really tough thing to endure.
It's grueling, and it's 7 days, and you know, I can't remember a New Year's or a Christmas Eve that I didn't work. I mean, and it's been this way for, on average for over 20 years.
Outside Formula One, which is, we can see that speaks to your heart.
Yeah.
What's your favorite movie score that you've done? Like the one that just stands out. Do you have one? Because they're all yours, right? They're all your product.
Yeah, I mean, I
which one's your baby?
It's impossible. I'll tell you what. Yeah, I can now say this is, it's Are We Dreaming? Because that's a direct. It is writing music from my soul that then informs how it's shot.
If someone was going to try and jump into your journey, which is, I actually think it's pretty tough, because you have meandered through life and been able to really exploit what you love and get away with it, right? Mm-hmm. And do it at a high level.
Yeah.
And it's unreal. So tell me, and this may be, I think it'll be topical for the listener, but it's unique to you. What do you prefer? What do you think is the most enjoyable experience? Being a DJ, producing a show, producing something for an entertainment brand like, or sports brand like F1 TV, or classic film composing, where you get to see a whole story unfold?
It's kind of like barbecue or sushi, you know what I mean? It's like, they're so different, but I would say that the process of being able to do something live is really gratifying, because when I work on movies, which I love doing and writing, it is done in a vacuum. I don't see the reaction of my audience. It's invisible because they're in the theater.
Mm.
But when I get to go and conduct in concert, it always surprises me. Or Are We Dreaming is also a live experience. So either one of those two, when you do it and you directly see their faces, you hear the cheering, and then you go and you talk to them afterwards, it's like this actually impacts people. And that can be lost, because I don't, you know, things online, and I get a lot of messages and stuff, but it's kind of hard to process that. But seeing someone face to face, and
another level,
it really is the thing that brings it home. And kind of most elucidates how music can impact someone, and more specifically my music, which is in that case kind of that means the world to me.
It's very clear to me as a movie auteur, also been in the industry 25 years, that when I think of blockbusters, the opportunity that was afforded to John Williams, who, you know, is a maestro, a genius, right? Working in his close partnership with Spielberg, he was able to take these colorful stories and create iconic moments that lasted, feel like they last, you know, many, many generations, right? You are now in a position where if you look at gross of movies, scope of movies, the biggest audiences that still watch what I call, what is considered a blockbuster.
Yeah, go to the theater.
It seems to be you, yeah. Right? So do you think you're going to have the opportunity? Do you want to do more of this blockbuster mantle, like to have that on your shoulders, right? And perhaps go and create these everlasting themes, like whether it be, I don't know, sci-fi themes like Close Encounters of a Third Kind or the family sci-fi like E.T. or Star Wars. Do you want that challenge, that responsibility?
Yeah, I mean, well for sure. And the thing is that I treat every film that I score like it's E.T. or Star Wars or Citizen Kane, no matter what. So the people that like know that the scores, sometimes in a title that you wouldn't expect, is a theme that for me it resonates at my very, very best, even if it's a movie title that seems kind of like, huh? Like the theme, if you watch the recording session on YouTube of the theme to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, right? Kind of like silly film, all that stuff. Kind of, you know, people, you hear the name, but if you listen to it, those are the things like I will always dive in and do my version of what John would do on these films that were clearly super classic films. And then if I'm doing Avengers or Iron Man or Thor or any of these things, the Thor theme, for instance, that you can see there's a live version on, you know, those ones that are kind of like those tunes that stick with you. John, he has the greatest movies of all time at the same time, you know, and so the idea of how many times will we have a Spielberg and a Lucas in their prime doing films at the same time. It's a rare kind of thing. Yeah. But what I always want to do is always treat everything that I'm doing from top to bottom as if they have achieved that level of Close Encounters. So I will give it my all no matter what. So in a sense, the music, I will always be doing it from the perspective of leaning into it and whether or not the vehicle that delivers the music to the people is that right. Or isn't going to really, it's not that it doesn't concern me. It would be great if it was like a movie like E.T. or whatever, but at the same time, I'm going to put the music out there for people to find regardless. And whether it's a blockbuster or a tiny film. And that's kind of, I think, always going to be my approach, but I will always, I feel very lucky to have done these movies that have these gigantic platforms. And, you know, it's like, it is bizarre to look at things that I never, for someone that was kind of like, I feel like I'm the perpetual outsider and not film school, not music school and everything. And there's like this list of like all time gross or whatever. And I'm like number 9 all time, some crazy thing. Like, you know,
You're up there.
And I'm like, how long?
Final boss.
I haven't been doing it. I feel like I just started. It's a weird, you know, I'm going to continue to do it and always give it my all, because that's what I want to leave behind, is just like some joy that people can hear.
Yeah. I got to ask, because it feels like what I take, and this might be really simple, but it's just like how curious and how deep you go into stuff. And it feels like that exploration drives what you do. Now, being who you are, doing so many things at the same time, do you still leave space in your day for that, to go deep into something that perhaps isn't like related to your work? So that could be the thing you draw on in 5 years. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So basically, if you're talking about, okay, so I'm just going to show you. Here's my phone, right? Right now, I'm watching The Origin of the Universe just got way weirder, and then Cyclical Universe Theory, This is what comes up for me: Civilization, Lifetimes, Five Unsolved Mysteries of the Universe, Biocentrism, Who Is This Man, so basically, like, it's anything that's like true science and debunking pseudoscience. And I just so that's why I love Brian. You know,
he's a dude.
And also Richard Dawkins, all sorts. All of that kind of thing was something that always fascinated me. And that's actually more what I studied anyway. I didn't go to, you know, music school or whatnot. So that
amazing.
Kind of that wonderment of existence and how small we are, like the Richard Penrose equation, being that basically everything relative in the universe
I get a feeling you're watching it while you're doing this interview. Gifted right now.
We're infinitely, basically nearly infinitely small and infinitely large by comparison from everything from atoms to, you know, galaxies. And that idea of our smallness and our, this tiny, tiny, tiny amount of time we're on this earth motivates me to do what I love and kind of not give a rip about the kind of the race, the rat race.
Yeah.
Comparing yourself to, why is this person doing this and I don't get to do this? Why am I playing on this stage and that guy's playing on that stage over there at the festival? I mean, all that bullshit is like kind of something that I think for me, science and especially physics and cosmology kind of keeps me
I love
centered.
That. Yeah. So you get over artistic insecurity via science it's amazing.
But what it really speaks to is this thing I talked to you about, Jax, about just distraction theory. And that's to get to the truth or the essence of yourself is to focus on things that make you happy. So as soon as we start to draw comparisons too early, we are already distracted. So your idea, your analogy of like, yeah, am I on this stage? I'm on that stage. Does it really matter? Are you doing something that makes you happy? Right.
Happy.
And that's it. All three of us are doing this, right? We go on this curiosity and this journey to find things that make us happy, right?
The sands of time will blow over everyone, and over time, the universe will be indifferent to the fact that humans even existed. A lot of people would get existential crisis, or that sounds like a down thing. For me, that is a beautiful thing because it is the great equalizer. The fact that I can't maybe necessarily get the same table as Steven Spielberg at a restaurant does not matter at all.
Is that a thing in Hollywood?
No.
Is that a thing?
I get Postmates.
Were you trying to go to the Chateau Marmont and you're like,
no,
dude, why am I not sitting over there? What the hell?
No, like, last night I Postmated at McDonald's, so don't even. I'm really lucky to be able to have shelter and sustenance and friends. And outside of that, the sands of time will judge us equally. And to me, that is just like a beautiful thing when you really start doing that horrible comparing and just that thing that can really get you into a thing where just do what you love as well as you can. Mm. And it's a beautiful thing, you know? And that's really why I started directing my own thing, Are We Dreaming? Because it was like, how many days do I have in my life?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, we all have, it's like tokens that you're using every day. You don't know how many tokens you have. I have probably about, let's say, 22,000 tokens left or something like that, you know? And at some point, you're going to be on token, one, you know? Drink, and that's it.
But there's also a sense of deep humility to you. Yeah, you know, if you can have that global perspective, right, or that great equalizer, I think that is an enabler for humility, and we all could do with some humility.
Yeah, I love your energy, bro. Yeah, that's fire.
Oh, for sure.
When Brian Cox started talking about, and by the way, guys, if you ain't listened to that episode, you guys need to check it out to hear what we're talking about. But when he started talking about the meaning of intelligence and our role within the universe and how the unlikely events that occurred for us to exist, it's like...
Me too.
That made me feel so comforted because it was just like, you can just do your thing it doesn't matter. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like everything else is just fabricated. Like your existence is important.
It is. We are artificially concerned with the hierarchy of human beings, especially at a point where, especially, you know, really exacerbates it is things like social media and a thumbs up, thumbs down culture and kind of keyboard warring and how many likes you got, how many followers you have, all that stuff that happens to, especially to artists and entertainers.
Yeah.
You can really get caught in an awful, it's like the event horizon. You're like on the event horizon of a black hole, just getting sucked down into which nothing escapes, not even light, not even your own like soul. Right. So like you really gotta guard yourself against those the modern black holes.
And does actually human productivity, i.e. the pursuit for existence, happens by being true to ourselves and just being who we are. And I'm a proponent and an optimist of that hopefully we get to be our best.
I hope it's the Carl Sagan pale blue dot. We're all living on one of tiny little blue marbles flying through space. Yeah. And here we are sharing the same air. What are we doing, like bonking each other over the head over invisible lines in the sand? And it's Brian's got it right in that sense that I think the beauty of respect for others and knowing that we are all tiny kind of makes it, in a sense, the fragility of the planet that we're on, that we should really be working together to get there. Unfortunately, everyone isn't on the same page, but we do our best. That is why I'm doing Are We Dreaming? It is the entire theme of Are We Dreaming? Which I'm directing. It's about our existence, and the very first shot is a tiny shot of Earth in the giant escape and it takes place at the beginning and it ends with the heat death of the universe. It's quite a project, and it relates to kind of what we're talking about.
And quite a scope. I look forward to seeing. I mean, that you've got probably nothing bigger in terms of scope.
It is a concert live experience, but that uses everything that cinema has, but it's different every single night. I am controlling the journey.
How is it different
journey.
Every single night?
I have done like 9 hours of finished footage and CG and music and the beginning point and the end point are the same, but how you get there is different. And I'm doing it live as I read the crowd. Is it more of a, like, are they going to get into a, you know, like a drum and bass thing? Is it more orchestral and introspective? I do all of that. It hits pretty much every genre in a fluid kind of way, but the journey is slightly different depending on the crowd. You can just tell different ages, different people are very different, how cosmic they want to get, how rowdy they want to get in that journey. And it's really it's a soul hitter, you know.
That's pretty cool, by the way. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
It sounds sick.
It
sounds sick.
Sure.
Are you bringing it over here to the UK?
Like immersive blackout. You walk in a room and it's like almost sensory deprivation. You can't even see where the screens are. It's all super super high tech, like beyond high def, where your brain can't even almost tell the difference between. It's not a pixel thing. Like, you can't even really tell the difference between the picture and your brain kind of reads it as reality. And you're constantly like going through wormholes. It's in 22 different countries. It goes sometimes following the story of an infant that all the way till the very last day and then backwards. And then music first and then everything else follows. So it's more like a concert and you're standing and you're experiencing it that way.
So it's supported by cinema, for want of a better word, or supported by
the visuals are everything I've learned from cinema, and I've been telling other people's narratives for 25 years, and this is my chance to tell my own narrative and tell a story. But everything is done music first, so I'll do the music. Sometimes it's like IDM, really ear candy. Sometimes it's big and epic and orchestral. Sometimes hip hop. I have a lot of hip hop artists. Sometimes music from India. Whatever it is, it's new music. And then that sets the stage, and then the story is kind of written and shot around that. Mm-hmm. And then the journey is different. As I've been testing it here in LA, there's been people that have seen it like 35 times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You can't, just permutations, you couldn't even do it the same way twice, even if you tried. I don't remember because I'm doing it live. So.
And it's different every time. I IDM as well. I like that intelligent dance music. Which is what IDM stands for. Yeah. Is that something you've coined?
No, it's something that I'm heavily involved with. It's basically like really ear candy, like brain, like when you hear it, it's just like, ooh, it tickles your brain, like about how kind of tasty, like the sound is like, oh, like, you know, you pull out all the air out of a mix and then like the most brain, like hi-fi, like how does it sound like that? It's just mind warping sound you can have. It's crazy.
Are there some master chords in getting that ear candy? Like, is there something concentric to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really playing a lot with, I call it like the Z axis of mixing, like X, Y, and then Z. It's like this way, like, it's like there's something that like this almost sounds like there's something that's like 1 inch in front of your eye and super tiny, like a little sound, and then it goes super wide and huge with a sub drop, and then a kick comes right in, and everything's super like side chained, and then all of a sudden it goes into like beauty and like a really milky kind of synth pad, and then back to the beat, and you're just like, whoa.
It's sensory, like ASMR.
Kind of, there is an ASMR feeling, like sometimes like a snare will have like a backwards water splash with it, and like, and then just going to dead zero and that really ASMR-y kind of, but like with music.
It seems to me like the thing that defines a great music score is ultimately that anchor theme, right? That thing can just run off on its own.
Theme first.
Right? Yeah. Theme first. Like, what is the essence to creating a great theme for you? Like, how do you get these one moment?
Now, that's a 10 out of 10 question.
Yes. Yeah,
I like that one.
So stuck the landing. So it's funny because, you know, John being a mentor of mine and us becoming friends over the years, it's funny we were talking about it. So I gave him he got his Lifetime Achievement Award in 2017, which was one of these. And I was one of the presenters and gave a speech about him and kind of what he means to us composers. And it was something I had mentioned. I was like, you know, there's something that you said that was like so key, or like you can kind of make, when you write music, you can make it that it's very complex and you can do harmonies and counterpoints and all this kind of window dressing. But when it comes down to it, can you take one finger and play it on the piano and remember it? And
ooh. Oh, great.
Yeah.
No way you think about that. You think about that?
That is exactly what I do every time. And so that was a John Williams advice. And so what I do is not, it's always going to be something, can you listen to it once and remember it? And that is absolutely the bar for me every time. If it's not that, whatever it is, if you can't instantly recall it, it's not good enough. And so what I do is, when I do in film, the one thing I do is I always go to the opening weekends. It's kind of weird, and I said this in a documentary once, but I go to the opening weekend and I will mill about after people are coming out of the theater, go into the restroom and like hang out, like, and like kind of like hide somewhere and hear if people are, if they are whistling the theme or humming the theme. And to me, if you take it home with you and it becomes part of your kind of your memory, then it becomes part of your soul. And that to me is the best piece of advice from John. To me, better than anything, the simplicity of it is the most difficult thing to do. And I think, and that's my mantra. That's what I live by as a composer, for sure.
What do you want to be? I know you want to produce your best work, but what is there left to do, or what would you want to be remembered for?
I think that at the end of the day, it's that composer of films that created Are We Dreaming? Is the thing that, because it's not something that's finished, it's something I'm going to continue to do and will evolve through the years. It's a never ending kind of, it's not like a movie where you finish and end, but this idea of doing a project that is truly me at the core, musically and narrative and visual storytelling, the whole thing, it kind of, it plays on me as a complete, like as a, every part of me, including me as being a visual artist, like all of it. And I feel that like sometimes composing is as a part of me, but it doesn't cover it. So if it ends up being that it's composers, the thing, that's great. But I think that the idea of being an artist that really put themselves out there to say something about who they were, that's important to me. That I do that in a way, and that's why I'm taking that. I'm giving it my all in terms of who I am, so people really kind of will know most directly who I am. Because in a way, with that, watching that, you almost get to know me better than if you sat down and had lunch with me. I'm able to speak through music and storytelling about what I think of the world and who I am much better than kind of I clumsily use grammar and words to try to explain music. It's just, it's like, I would rather like an epitaph be just some music playing.
Well, it feels like the best is yet to come.
Yeah.
I'm excited, man. I'm excited to see your, what would you describe it? Your cinematic experience, Are We Dreaming?
Yeah.
I can't wait.
Yeah, it's a journey through time and space and who we are, for sure.
It's so cool.
Brian, it's been a real pleasure. This has been so much fun. It's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
He means that as well. I can see it by his smile. Look at that.